Succession number 10225, reel number 1.
I would say, though, in that tape, he's still climbing.
It wouldn't surprise me. Blast its thing up. Very good listening like that.
I don't suppose. Where did you get the tape, then?
We got it out the BBC Sound Archives. I just thought, well, let's try the BBC first.
Yes.
See if they've got a tape.
Yes.
And that's their Lancaster in-flight sequence.
Right. Well, I think that what you really need is a much longer tape
to
get it.
Well, I think,
and at a guess, I would say the people to approach are the RAF Battle of Britain
flight. Well, we can get onto the Battle of Britain Memorial flight for a start and get a recording there. I was thinking we'd probably have to do that,
because you see, once you get into a cruising situation, you get
a much
softer sound. Really, I mean, it's noisy as hell.
Oh yeah,
and I went deaf from it, basically. But it's a very much softer sound than that.
I'm not surprised. It was noisy enough when I had the...
And it comes down to a sort of... Mm. Zoom, zoom, zoom,
I expect you get the beats.
You know, like that. Once they've got the props all synchronised, and that it comes down to a much more even sort of sound in flight.
Hang on, I'll just grab my notes. I'm so dreadful at taking notes anyway. There's one interesting thing that... there's probably a red herring that keeps cropping up. Is someone we were speaking to saying that when he was flying in Lancasters, they had a psycho code machine. I don't know if you've come across that.
No, we had a code of the day, which was a book, a little booklet, in which the code letters were printed, and they were merely the meaning of them was changed around.
Yeah, I've heard of that sort of thing
every day.
Would that booklet be sort of to hand all the time?
Yes, except, it was to hand all the time, on operational flying, not necessarily on just ordinary day-to-day flying.
So you'd say you'd have that would be one of the things you'd have by the key in front of it.
Yes.
So you'd have a code of the day booklet.
You'd have the code of the day, which was this stereo, this set-type code book. All the groups in it were pre-printed. Mm. And all that happened was that the significance changed around. The meanings, they sort of, you know...
Yeah, I think I've heard that
today's, you know, ABC didn't mean what tomorrow's would mean, and yes or yesterday's. Mm. So if one fell into German...
Yeah, that's it. It didn't compromise the entire system.
I suppose you
just have a message pad.
We had a logbook. And as I recall, I don't remember message pads.
No messages.
No, things were just recorded in the logbook.
Would you just write it in pencil? Or
yes, always in pencil.
Just a little pencil.
Yes. You can take a fountain pen up because it would just leak all over the place.
Of course it would, yes.
It hadn't got Virex in those days. Yeah. 4 points weren't known yet. Mm. So all we had was pencils. Mm. The old wooden pencil, plain wooden ministry, air ministry pencil.
Air ministry pencil, just plain wood. How did you shut up, then?
I don't remember.
That's a silly question. I'm just curious.
Silly question, yes. I suppose we just took them up sharp. And
yeah, I just think...
We had the razor blade with us, you know. Mm. Took a razor blade along to do it.
The navigator was a completely separate person from the wireless operator.
Yes.
I presume he'd be sitting at his desk throughout most of
the
flight.
He never left his desk.
Because this is one of the things where we've come slightly unstuck, because we didn't realise that looking from the main spar forward like that, so wireless operator there. Mm. Look,
the navigator's there. Yeah.
Blasted silly if you didn't have a navigator.
That's right. He was sitting right alongside, to the forward part of the cabin. Mm. In fact, I've got some photographs at home. Take it inside the aircraft, looking back from the navigator to the wireless. So not very clear. Mm. Not as clear as these sorts of things.
Yes, it would be very, it'd be very helpful if we could borrow these photographs and copy them.
Right, I'll take copies for you.
Getting photographs of the thing, because you see, yes, all these wiring looms and things like that.
Well,
we've got
that
sort of roughly.
Yeah, that is more difficult for me, to tell you the truth. Because I don't really remember now after all this time exactly where the bits and pieces went. What you really want to get hold of for that is possibly a wireless mechanic. Mm.
Well, what we have got, we do know of a chap who, for a private sort of, his private purposes, is reconstructing a Lancaster wireless operator's position.
Oh, yeah.
So just photographing his thing,
copying his
work.
Yes.
I presume you had a light on all the time.
Well, we had a little light which was a dimmer. Mm. Had a dimmer switch.
Yeah, so the light had a dimmer switch.
And it was one of those little tubular type lights. Spotlight type of thing. And had a dimmer to it. And wouldn't keep it on necessarily all the time. It had a rheostat on it. You know, you could turn
it
out.
So you just keep
because, it. Because on the astrodome above your head, you had the blackout curve drew across. As you realise, there is an astrodome up there.
Yes.
And above your head, you had the astrodome, you had the blackout curtain across it, and just pull that across. And then, I mean, because the wireless operator's one of his jobs, amongst the others, was to keep a lookout as well for enemy aircraft.
Yeah.
When he wasn't actually operating. Now, on an operational flight, as a Pathfinder aircraft, we had more function than perhaps than anyone else, because we listened out to group broadcasts every 20 minutes.
Yes.
Now they would come through with a message. The call sign of the of the group sending station and a number. Just a single digit.
Yeah.
On 1 to 10. That digit was the check on the wireless operator when he got back that he had in fact been listening to group broadcasts and hadn't been listening to the BBC or something.
Yes, and this would be in plain language.
No, it was just a call sign.
This would
and a number.
Of course, you see, I know very little about radio.
No, okay.
So it would be
a call sign would be the call sign of the sending station.
Mm. Could you just
APXT or something?
What would be a typical sort of?
Well, the typical call sign would have been, for instance, 8LY.
8LY.
8LY was probably, if I remember rightly, that was 8 group.
Yes, so that would have been...
8LY was Gravely.
So that would have been transmitted in Morse.
That would have been sent in Morse.
And with a number, say, 8LY...
With a number, say, 8.
8.
8LY, then 7. 8LY7. Mm. Now, if there was a message to be transmitted, yeah, then they transmitted the message in that group broadcast every 20 minutes throughout the flight.
Every 20 minutes. Because I'm thinking the fact that we could...
Hour, 20 past and 22.
Hour, 20 past and 22. So they would transmit... They'd say... They'd transmit their call sign twice.
Well, then they keep this up for about 5 minutes.
Oh, they just... Oh, that's interesting.
And they keep this... The broadcast would be... The group broadcast would be going for about 4 or 5 minutes. And they'd just send the call sign and a number. Call sign and a number. Call sign and a number. If you were getting a number, you knew they had nothing, no further instructions to send you. But yes, if they had an instruction, for instance, one night when we'd set off to, where was it? One of the German towns now. Yeah. We got a recall. Now, we got out as far as probably halfway across the North Sea. And when I turned tuned into the group broadcast, there was call signs and there was an actual message transmitted on that occasion. When I had decoded the message, it said, "Return to base." That was all.
That's interesting, because one of the sort of ideas we had is every now and then, for variety, putting a message over the...
Now, the other function that the wireless operator had was, of course, was a backup to the navigator. This was his one of his big functions, right?
Yeah.
Because he could get bearings, he could ask for fixes, he could ask for assistance of all sorts by Morse. That's transmitting by Morse.
Yeah.
He could ask his home base station, direction finding station, for a bearing back to base. And this would be, he would just come up for the QDM, as it is, so that's part of the Q code, an international Q code still. Mm. QDM was, what is my, what is my direction to fly to reach you?
Yeah.
Sort of idea. And the parent airfield would acknowledge his transmission. And then the wireless operator clamped his key down. So if you see on that key, there's a little button on there.
So that's important. We must have that little clamp there.
You must have that key. That's a genuine key. And it's all encased in a plastic case. He would press his key down, flick that button over it to hold it down for a few moments. The home station would take a bearing on the aircraft. He then unflick that key. And this home station would send him his bearing, the course to fly to reach that reach that station, so he could get a bearing. If he was completely lost, he called up the medium frequency direction finding stations, MFDF stations as they were known, and they were dotted around England. Now, he carried, while this operator carried with him, a flimsy with all these codes in it.
Yeah.
So he knew exactly where to call.
That's different.
And
that's different.
They were probably all marked up on this table
see.
Here.
So that would
see
be
that
the
plaque on the front there. Right?
Yeah.
He very often, I'll come to that in a minute, would pre-tune his set, but he could ask them for a fix.
Yeah.
And the master station of the three stations would answer him and tell him to go ahead. He would again clamp his key down. The master station would take a bearing and two slave stations would take a bearing. And where they crossed, the slave stations would immediately inform the master station, who informed the wireless operator in the air what his position was.
Some stuff.
The wireless operator could also, of course, transmit and receive messages for his aircraft of any sort at all. But largely, his transmitting work consisted of getting bearings and fixes and things like that. Now, there was, of course, his very, very, very important function, which was when the aircraft was badly damaged and in trouble. That's when he came into the wireless operator, really came into his own. Because if the aircraft was badly damaged over Germany and could be flying home and about to ditch in the sea, the crew depended on the wireless operator being capable of doing
it. And that's when he really came into
his own. That's when he came into his own. Because he could save their lives. And he operated the dinghy radio once they were out of the aircraft as well. So that was another function he had. And the procedure there, of course, was that he called up on the MFDF stations and sent out an SOS. The MFDF stations would answer him, and he would continue sending for this SOS and clamping his key down, so they would be keeping a permanent fix on the aircraft as it went down.
Yeah.
And that only in the last minutes, when the rest of the crew had gone to the to their ditching stations, the wireless operator and the pilot would still be at their positions.
Yeah.
And at the last minute, when the pilot told him he was about to go in, the wireless operator would clamp his key down, leave his set, and go and take up a ditching station in the, over the main spar.
Not very pleasant.
No. So you've got, you know, that was really...
Otherwise, the wireless operator didn't really have all that much to do.
He had a knowledge of the circuits of the of the aircraft. He had a knowledge of the circuits of the an intercom system, which he could repair in an emergency. He knew the workings of his set. He could knew the emergency procedures to carry out repairs on that. If necessary, if the intercom failed, which was a separate system, he could feed it in through the wireless here, and through the wireless he could set up an emergency intercom system.
Oh, that's interesting.
So the intercom went through the radio.
Hmm.
Was connected in.
That's intriguing.
But when he was using it through the radio, in order to protect the radio, he could only have about three people on the intercom at any one time.
Yeah. Otherwise, it did something nasty to the radio.
Yes. Otherwise, it blow one of the valves in the radio.
What sort of kit would you normally be wearing when you were?
The wireless operator would be wearing certainly flying boots and heavy socks. Probably he wore a pair of I always wore a pair of electrically heated shoes, slippers.
Oh yes, I've heard of those.
Because that was the part of me that got the the coldest, quite honestly. But by and large, the wireless operator wasn't too bad because the hot air duct came out near him.
Yes,
And he got sometimes he was too hot.
Mm.
But. The basic kit, I suppose, was he'd be wearing flying boots. This is all in case the heating failed, obviously.
Yes.
He'd be wearing his flying boots, he'd be wearing socks, he'd be wearing a pair of long john underwear, a long heavy woolen vest, shirt on the top of that, probably collar and tie usually as well on top of that. He'd wear a white roll neck pullover.
Mm. Oh, that's useful.
His battle dress top over that, battle dress trousers on.
Yeah.
And on the top of that, he'd wear the May West. And on the top of that, he'd have his parachute harness.
Yeah.
He'd wear a flying helmet and an oxygen mask with a microphone in it, the same as all the rest of rest of the crew did. He had gloves. He had silk gloves, silk inner gloves. And he had leather gauntlets as well.
Yes. Did you usually tend to wear the silk?
No, not really. Not in a Lancaster. We did in a Halifax.
Yeah.
Because in a Halifax, the wireless operator's position is down in the nose.
Ah.
It's a completely different position, and it was freezing down there because he got no heat at all. And that's when I used to wear electrically heated slippers and all my
everything in there.
Because being down the nose there, even our navigator with that on, he's still got a cross-bitten toe. So that shows how cold it got in Halifax. But in the Lancaster, he was much warmer and probably didn't really need all that much kit. In fact, in summertime, I had more than once flown in shirt sleeves. Foolishly, looking back now, because if we'd been shot down and bailed out, I'd found myself over the other side in the middle of the night in shirt sleeves. You know, it wouldn't have been funny. But... took the battle dress top along, you know, took all that along, had a pullover along with us, and probably put all that on as we got as we gained height, you know. But for the first 100 miles or so, we'd be flying out over the North Sea towards Denmark at 0 feet, you know, about 100 feet up. And in the summertime, it was quite pleasant and warm, you know.
Yeah.
So
that's that. That, as I said, is the receiver, and that is the transmitter.
Yeah.
Now, the transmitter had these coloured knobs on it, or has these coloured knobs on it, which are the different ranges.
Yeah.
Right? Different ranges, and the frequencies of those ranges are set out pretty well clearly on the set itself. Yeah. Right. And you could pre-tune those. For instance, you could set one set to the to the nearest DF stations, and the other one to your home base station, and the other one was left loose. So that all you had to do in order to come onto the DF stations was to turn switches, two switches, click click, and your transmitter was set. You didn't have to start tuning in and finding the other guy. You could tune that set to that set.
Yeah.
And of course vice versa. Mm. But I mean, basically what you did was you tuned in on your receiver, you tuned in to the station that you wanted, and then you tuned your transmitter to your receiver.
Mm.
At the side here, just behind his head there, and I don't know if you can see it on here, you'll have the aerial switch.
Yes.
Which switched the aerial for the various ranges. Now, I don't see one on there.
Yeah.
I think that's one thing I know we've got to copy.
It should be in here, alongside here, and it's just a big switch that with a big handle on it, and it switches from various things, because you carry the trailing aerial.
Mm.
I think, if I remember, it's 250 feet.
Oh.
A trailing aerial, which was a fairly decent steel cable with a set of little steel balls on the end of it to give it weight. And that is on a reel at the left-hand side of the wireless operator down here.
Yes. And you would reel this in and out.
And you would reel this in and out. You reeled it out once you had got to a certain height. And that was, if I remember rightly, that was the medium frequency aerial for MF transmissions. 250 feet of it trailed out behind the aircraft, and you wound this in very, very quickly when the pilot was landing, and you tried to get it in before it caught on a tree or a fence, and you lost it, because if you lost it, you had to pay for it.
That's typical.
One of the few things that the Air Force did make you pay for.
It was the aerial.
I know, because I lost one. I lost one in the trees coming into land. It was quite a job to reel it in. I mean, it was a lot of wire to reel in on that thing. They by hand to put a bit of it. Then you had on the top of the aircraft, you had the fixed aerial.
Oh yeah.
I'm rambling a bit on this, I know, but you'll be able to pick this out.
Yeah, well, that's the idea.
Now, on the top of that, you had the fixed aerial in a V shape to the
thing,
and that was also connected to your aerial switch, as was your DF loop. Now, the direction finding loop is situated just forward there of the astrodome.
Yeah.
And it's actually under the perspex canopy of the aircraft.
Mm.
Right? That was another feature of the wireless operator's functions, was that he could get directions from the aircraft itself. He didn't have to call for QDM or anything like that. If his transmitter was blown out for any reason, he could still operate with the receiver. He could operate the direction finding equipment himself on the aircraft. And this consisted of a direct DF loop up top with a goniometer reaching down just underneath, just over his head here.
Yeah.
I don't see it in here at all. It should come down from the top there. And operating this, he could tune to his home station, for instance, his airfield radio transmitter, and he could take a bearing on it himself, and then give the pilot instructions where to fly. Now, in addition to that, he could feed that direction finding aerial through his receiver onto a little gadget on the pilot's cockpit.
Oh, that's clever.
And that had two needles that crossed, like that, a left and a right. And you'll see here, there's a little switch here on the top with L and R on it, right, which is left and right. When the needles went down to the right, the pilot knew he was going off to the left. When it went the other way, he knew he was going off the other way.
Yeah.
So all he had to do was to keep those two needles crossed on a center line on that dial.
Mm.
And he would be, theoretically anyway,
flying
towards the station from which the transmission was coming.
Mm.
The little left and right switch enabled the wireless operator, once he'd fixed the station, to determine whether it was forward or behind him.
Oh.
Because he switched the left or the right hand side of the loop. And whichever it was loudest on, that gave me a signal. I mean, he fired towards it an object, the signal's coming from the front. So this half of the loop is getting more than the back,
half.
Right. So he then switched to see which way. If he overflew if he overflew the station, then of course he would be getting a reading behind him, and he'd know he'd gone too far.
It's all clever stuff.
Now, all these things worked within reasonable limits. You know, they weren't perfect because it was, let's face it, the 1940s radio wasn't as developed as it is today. In fact, this whole Marconi setup here, this 1154-55, was a hell of an advance on what had gone before. Because the radio sets before this were extremely primitive. And you actually had to change coils and crystals in them, you know, still.
Yeah.
And this was a tremendous advance where you could just tune it, you know, straight off, and no bother at all. It all had coloured knobs on it to preset, and it was extremely, extremely clever stuff, that was.
Let's see how it's...
Of course, for this radio equipment, there was a special generator on the aircraft, and a battery, and an ordinary, you know, like a car battery, 12 volts, if I remember, 24 volt batteries, and there was a generator which whipped up, I think, about 1,200 volts or something like that for the transmitter. So it was quite a hefty, you could get quite a hefty jolt. If you've got your hand across that key, this is why it's encased in Bakelite.
Oh, I see.
If you've got your hand across that key, you've got a nasty jolt. Because, you know, it was a hell of a lot of power going through it. You carried, of course, you had your all your wire coming through your helmet, and that you plugged that in at the side, up down there. What else do you have on there that I can describe to you? The trailing area of the reel, the thing, the jig. He had, of course, his oxygen connector there. He also operated, of course, the wireless operator also operated some of the radar equipment, which was at this side of him. Yeah. Mainly the the artifact, if I remember rightly, called Monica, which detected enemy aircraft coming up behind. Also, the radar, which he had to preset from time to time, which automatically scanned the radar frequencies and locked onto any radar set that was German radar set onto them, and it transmitted a signal back which affected the German radar.
Oh, that's clever.
And this thing had a little red light glowing on it. Now, when it fixed itself on a German radar beam, that would go on, the red light would go on, the wireless operator would watch it for a minute or two. If it didn't resume searching after it had done its jamming, then he had to reset it so that it went on searching again for further things like that.
What sort of date would that be?
1944.
This would be 44?
Yes, I'm talking about 1944.
This is about 44,
yes. I suppose besides his logbooks and his pencils, he also carried information on practically every station in England that had every RAF field, its call signs and its frequencies, so that he could call up. He also was the keeper or the guardian, if you like, of the Darkie frequency. Now, Darkie is something not a lot of people know about. These days, but Darkie was very much used in those days, and it was usually used on the VHF radio, which was the voice radio for which was operated by the pilot. That had four channels on it only, A, B, C, and D. Channel A was usually his airfield control tower. B was, I can't remember what B would have been, C, but D was a set frequency, and I've got the frequencies if you want them, I've got them at home, information on that. That was Darkey. Now, Darkey was a preset frequency, and on every airfield of any size in England, there was a Darkey watch.
Oh, yes.
In the control tower, there was a Darkey radio set. Mm. And if you got into trouble and all your radio equipment was blown out, you could, via the intercom, go and tell the pilot to press button D, and he went on to, you were on the Darkey frequency, you then could call out, hello Darkey, hello Darkey, hello Darkey, this is XYZ aircraft, you gave your home base, your call sign, for instance.